What's happening, everybody, and how the hell are y'all doing out there? Today's guest for the Crash Bang Boom podcast, episode number 269, is Chris Mills of Chicago's own Harm's Way. The new record entitled Common Suffering that they worked on with producer Will Yip is out and available everywhere. Just haven't been released this past Friday, so be sure to check that bad boy out. Tour dates start October 18th throughout the entire U.S. in support of said record and can be found at harmsway13.com, so hopefully y'all can catch them on the road. Chris and I get into everything from go-to snare drums to the origins of the band to the impetus of his straight-edge lifestyle to experiences working with Kurt Ballou and Will Putney on previous records all the way up to Will Yip on Common Suffering and much more. So hope y'all enjoy it. Today's episode is sponsored by my man Carson Gant, a.k.a. 1UpLoops.com. Carson and his team spent a preposterous amount of time recording over 450,000 shaker, tambourine, and hi-hat loops at every possible tempo in multiple fields with incredible mics and outboard gear for you to pick and choose. It's organized for you to find exactly what you need with just a few clicks, and everything feels and sounds incredible. You can sign up for free to check it out and gain full access to all 450,000 loops starting at just $6 a month. No download limits, whatever you want, whenever you want. New loops, one-shots, and drum breaks are being added weekly. And as someone who's used it previously, I can certainly vouch for it, and I hope y'all check it out. And that's 1UpLoops.com. Crash Bang Boom Podcast can be found on all streaming platforms, podcast platforms, etc. Feel free to check out any of the previous 260-plus episodes or give me a like, a subscription, and or a positive review, as it is appreciated. So without further ado, here we go. Let's get into it. Chris Mills, Harm's Way, Common Suffering. Get up on it. Crash Bang Boom!
Crowds go mad with joy.
All right, I'm here with Chris Mills of Harm's Way. New album, Common Suffering, due out this Friday the 29th, which will be prior to the release of this episode by a few days. But, Chris, how are you doing, man?
Doing good, man. Making it home from work, and psyched to be here.
Right on, man. Well, tell me a little bit about the writing and recording and ultimate release of this new record.
You know, it's crazy to think we recorded this album a little over a year ago. So we spent last summer in kind of like two different blocks. We recorded it in Philadelphia with Will Yip at Studio 4.
Okay.
And the early part of the summer, we spent 2 weeks over there doing pre-production for the album, just writing some new stuff, finalizing pre-existing material. Kind of took those songs back home, sat with them some more, just really rehearsed the hell out of them. And then towards the end of the summer, we flew back, did a couple extra days of pre-production, and then spent another 2 weeks tracking the album.
Gotcha. Was that a different process than the ones previously? And we can talk about sort of the engineering, mix-in, producer, et cetera, specifics of those records. But was this different in that you sort of did it in two different blocks in another state?
Yeah, yeah. You know, we recorded Posthuman, our last record with Will Putney, at Graphic Nature Audio. And that was actually like the first time we actually like took any time to do any sort of real kind of pre-production. And with that record, we only did a few days of that. And then we hopped into like the recording process over the course of 3 weeks. But I would say like every record before that, so Rust, Isolation, No Gods, No Masters, Blinded, like you name it, right? We weren't really a band that did like pre-production by any means. We just wrote the songs, rehearsed a lot of them, showed up, and recorded, you know? So
right.
It was definitely a different process in terms of just how just like meticulous we were with the songs and how focused we were in terms of trying to like look at this album as a cohesive piece of art, piece of music, and making sure we were kind of checking all the boxes and hitting all the marks with what we wanted to get out of the album.
It's interesting that you did pre-production. You went to the studio that you're ultimately going to record it and did the pre-production there. Previously for me, I've done, well, I haven't had that many out-of-state recording experiences really, but I just demoed stuff and recorded everything that I could and fleshed out tempos and clicks and everything else prior to just sort of doing rough demos in-house, and then sort of all came to an agreement on where the song should be at a BPM level and dynamic-wise, et cetera, arrangement, and then go in. But why go to the studio to do that?
Yeah. So, you know, we definitely did a lot of that too, right? Like we essentially took like almost 2 years to write this record. And a lot of that was impacted by, of course, the pandemic. Our guitar player and our bass player Casey and Nick, like they live up in Milwaukee too. And over the course of the pandemic, you know, we weren't really kind of getting together,
right?
Health concerns and all that good stuff. So, you know, a lot of that was actually done kind of over Zoom, you know, recording stuff. You know, Nick and Casey would kind of like put it into Ableton. We'd kind of like send it back and forth, kind of workshop stuff, send notes. You know, when things started to kind of start opening up again, we started kind of playing together, writing together again. And, you know, we spent a lot of time almost like kind of stripping everything down and like writing what felt like a entirely new record, you know? Mm-hmm. But even during that process too, like we were really leaning into writing on a computer, you know, being able to kind of program drums, workshop stuff. So we sent Will kind of all the demos we had that were essentially programmed, right? And we wanted to use that time to actually kind of get together and play those songs with him in the room with us to really kind of get just a different set of ears on that stuff, like kind of get his opinions kind of. And some of these, like a lot of the songs we had were, you know, maybe 70-80% done. So we really wanted to work with someone who can help like kind of flesh out that additional 20%. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, you know, like we spent a lot of that time, I'd say writing about 3-4 more songs for the album too, you know? And it just, you know, it really gave us a lot of time to just kind of get into kind of the creative process with like no other outside noise, right? Because a lot of us kind of have outside jobs, you know, kind of outside careers, kind of stuff of that nature, you know? So mm-hmm. we really use that time to just almost have it be like this pilgrimage, so to speak, where we're able to just like really focus on the writing process and like getting the album where we wanted it to be. And again, with like kind of Will's set of ears, so to speak, and some of his suggestions, you know, just kind of helping us elevate our game and helping elevate the record where we wanted it to be.
Nice. So that sounds like a semi-traditional producer experience in that yeah. there was insight and sort of objective ideas and such offered in y'all going out there and presenting sort of what y'all had and y'all being open to it, which is a whole nother thing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and yeah, it's like I was kind of saying earlier, you know, like with a good chunk of our band's history, you know, there's always been this kind of like kind of punk rock mentality, you know, it's just like our music, we do it our way, you know, just kind sure. of like kind of closed off to suggestions, you know, and I would say like, you know, from like Posthuman on, it's just opening ourselves up to that process, right? And again, allowing the songs, allowing the creative process to go to places where it may have not gone before.
Gotcha, man. With the Rust album and signing with Deathwish, going back a few records, how was it having Kurt Ballou mix the record and sort of how was that experience with that record? Because that one also sounds great. I'm also, in full disclosure, if anyone has listened to this podcast, they know that I'm a big fan of Kurt Ballou's records. So, you know, I've got a lot of them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, our friend Andy Nelson, who did all of our records up until that point, he tracked that record, and all of us in the band, we've been longtime Converge fans, longtime God City fans. So it was kind of a bucket list thing for us to be able to kind of work with Kurt in that capacity, you know, obviously being such a big fan of him in so many ways for so long. So that was huge for us, you know, and I felt like, you know, he really helped kind of take our sound to a place that we were really trying for so long, you know? So overall, amazing experience. And it was like actually on that record cycle, you know, I think maybe a year down the line, we were able to actually do some touring with Converge over in Europe, which was also awesome. And, you know, all those guys are great.
That's interesting, man. I think, yeah, in listening to sort of the discography, there's a noticeable shift in production, sort of heightened production, if you will, starting certainly with that record. And I think y'all have done a really good job of maintaining that vibe of having a big, heavy production with keeping some of the sort of live energy in it. I'll even ask you some snare drum questions because I've liked your snare drum sound on all three of those records, especially. Beyond Rust, for the Posthuman record, you signed to Metal Blade and work with Will Putney. Sort of, how did signing with Metal Blade differ or from, I guess, Deathwish? Or really, more importantly, I guess, how did working with Will sculpt either the sound or approach or any of that for that record?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously like signing with Metal Blade was cool. You know, it obviously like opened up a lot of doors for us in terms of like what what we wanted to do with an album, you know, in terms of having like some of like the freedoms, you know, financially, so to speak, you know? And obviously it gave us the opportunity to work with Putney, which, you know, up until that point, like we were kind of like weighing different producers and different engineers. And, you know, Will was a name that kind of came up and someone we had been fans of as well, you know, for some years in terms of records he had done, you know? And, you know, it was cool, right? Because that was the first time. So, you know, just to like backtrack a bit, like Andy Nelson, you know, who did all of our records up to Posthuman, you know,
right.
Or say up to Rust. And then obviously Will started with Posthuman. Mm-hmm. He was located in Chicago, you know, literally just like down the street from us, you
gotcha.
Know? So like, we like did so many of those records, like in between, you know, shifts from work, you know, just on weekends, you know, just like not really being able, you know, like never like everyone in the same room together kind of doing a record, right? It was always like kind of spliced up, you know, to kind of fit everyone's schedule and like accommodate the craziness of everyone's life, you know? So like kind of going to Putney, going to Graphic Nature, was like our first time really just like, okay, we're gonna make a record together, you know, this is what we're doing for the next 3 weeks, you know? Will creates like, I should say Putney. I'm just using Putney because we're talking about
we're gonna start mixing up the Wills.
Yeah. You know, obviously like that studio, it's produced so many great records, but it's also like such a cool space to just like be in. And we were just hanging out for 3 weeks. And the primary focus was music, hanging out, maybe going to the gym at night, you know, but just like really being with one another. And it really helped just, I think, that vibe and that space just like kind of really helped craft that, like the sound and the overall product that we had with that record. And I think, you know, as a producer as well, like Putney is incredible. You know, I have nothing but positive things to say in terms of how he pushed us and the space he created for us to create, I should say, you know?
Yeah.
It was just an amazing experience, you know? And like, we can't think of doing a record any other way now where we are as just disjointed as we used to be back in the day.
Absolutely, man. You know, I mean, when you're just if you're starting out a band, obviously you never really know where it's going to go or if it's going to dissolve, and bands are always complicated. But here y'all are, what, 17 some odd years later. I mean, are you surprised where it's taken you thus far?
Every single day.
Yeah.
Every single day, you know. You know, Harm's Way started back in 2006 as a side project to another band we were doing at that time called Few and the Proud, which was just like a straight edge hardcore band, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just kind of grew out of this like idea of like, hey, like we should have James, you know, who was playing bass in Few and the Proud at the time, sing for a band. Like that would be cool, you know? And we literally just all like kind of swapped instruments because I was playing guitar in Few and the Proud at the time. And I just jumped behind the drum kit and we started writing, you know, Power Violence songs in the vein of, you know, kind of Infest and Crossed Out and whatnot, you know?
Right.
And, you know, it's we didn't really have any like goals in mind. We just wanted to have fun and just make a demo, you know, but like slowly but surely, you know, like the more we did, the more traction the kind of band gained. And we just kind of rode that wave, so to speak, you know, we never anticipated it kind of growing or kind of getting to the level that it's at today. But in some ways, I feel like the fact that we never, you know, quote unquote, like we're trying, so to speak, just allowed us to just stay like really open-minded and just like kind of in this like grateful headspace and like this willing headspace that whenever a cool opportunity kind of showed up, we jumped on it. Right.
Right. I mean, one of the toughest things is to have an assemblage of people in a band that can jump on those opportunities when they do arise, especially in the form of touring. Because I mean, as I've said many times previously, it's not as if it gets easier. You know, I mean, it just doesn't. Not only in your age, but just in life to do that. So just to even retain a group of people in a band that can take advantage of those scenarios. I mean, that alone, it is kind of a victory in and of itself. And that's a part of why I think y'all have been able to do it is because y'all have been able to take advantage of those situations.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and Harm's Way in a lot of ways was like never really like a linear journey, right? Like we were always doing the band while we were in, you know, school. We always were doing the band when we were doing jobs, right? We're doing the band while I was in grad school. Like, you know, and it was always just like, we'll do shit when we can, you know, and we'll make it happen when we can, you know, and if we can make it work, we'll make it work, you know? And it was like around the time, you know, after we signed to Deathwish and Blinded came out, then Rust came out, I was like finishing grad school at that time. And it's just like opportunity after opportunity after opportunity.
Right.
And I was just kind of like, all right, like, fuck it. Let's try to do something with this, you know? And, you know, that was shit, man. That was like back in, you know, 2015, right? And here we are in 2023, and we're kind of able to do this band in far more of a full-time capacity than we would have ever imagined.
That's crazy. What did you go to grad school for?
So I went to grad school for social work. I'm a therapist. I work in addiction and mental health. So I've been able to kind of balance the two for a while. Obviously, over the course of the pandemic, my life was pretty insane.
Oh yeah.
You know, kind of working full time and doing that, like keeping my clinical practice going. I've always been able to do Harm's Way as well, as it's been such a big part of my life.
Awesome, man. It's when I think about, you mentioned, I think Power Violence sort of early on, some of those influences, et cetera. It's one of those phrases or subgenres, subgenres that I was really not aware of until I saw the Locust live, not knowing who they were, being completely shocked by how outrageous and just insane everything that they did was. And then sort of in researching them, hearing this Power Violence thing, and I was like, is that what that is? And then I realized, well, they were influenced by it, but then there were some of the bands, like even you mentioned, it's, I don't know, did you ever by any chance get a chance to see the Locust live?
I did not get a chance to see the Locust live. I did see, you know, I saw Some Girls live before, and I think there was members of the Locust mm-hmm. in that, but you know, I was always really familiar with the Locust kind of through high school and stuff. Cause there was like, and a lot of friend groups who were adjacent to mine, like liked that band, you know,
yeah.
But never had a chance, only heard stories, but you know, obviously a great band.
It was so insane. I, again, to know nothing about them, I had the same experience with Dillinger Escape Plan. I knew nothing about them and just walked in. They opened up for Mr. Bungle and I saw them. And of course the same reaction was just like, what the fuck am I seeing? And who is this drummer? Both Gabe Serbian, rest in peace, and Chris Penny at the time for Dillinger Escape Plan. But yeah, to know nothing. I mean, it was a bizarre show. I was convinced that, as was my friend, that the Locusts were Japanese. They kind of had like this kind of spastic melt banana thing going, and they had the masks on and the uniforms and everything. So it's not like we could see them. We could only just hear their voices. And we were just like, I guess this is like some crazy spazzy band, like with a bunch of wild Japanese guys. Gabe Serbian like stepped away from his drum set after just playing crazy blast beats with cymbal catches and vomited, and then like got back on. And I was like, are they, I didn't understand any. I was like, there was no precedent for it. I did not understand what the fuck I was seeing. So
yeah. I feel like, you know, if that's your introduction to Power Violence, like, yeah, you're going to be really taken back by it for sure. It's, I mean, and I think that's like the amazing thing about like power. And then, you know, look, Power Violence is like a really hard genre to really kind of like categorize. And I'm sure like, many would probably want to get into like a debate with us over whether or not the Locusts are or not Power Violence. Right. But at the end of the day, it's like, it's fucking insane music, and both recorded and in a live setting. And I mean, I think that's why I love it so much. It's just so unpredictable. You know what I mean? And you don't know what you're kind of stepping into.
Absolutely, man. And you mentioned that like the straight edge thing. It's funny, like me being out of New Orleans, which is an entire city based on like drinking and eating. And like the main heavy band, I would say Export. I Hate God is one of the ones that's been consistently around forever. And those guys, clearly not a straight edge band. Like, and they kind of in many ways represent sort of the drunken decadence and of that city. So similar to Power Violence, which was, I was like, what is that? I really didn't know much about, I mean, I think when I heard Minor Threat, I heard people saying like, yeah, that's like a straight edge thing. And I was like, wow, what is that? Mm-hmm. You know, it was just so not in anywhere in the stratosphere of the kind of drunken party town that is New Orleans. But at which point did that scene or that sort of ideology or whatever you would want to call it, ethos, when did that start influencing you, I guess?
It was at a pretty young age for me. And it's actually like a pretty like kind of personal story. You know, I was introduced to punk, hardcore, hip hop, kind of like all things cool, including straight edge, like by my older brother, you know. Okay. My brother kind of introduced me to straight edge as like a form of like kind of safe passage for me, as I would probably call it.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, like my brother was like struggling with like a pretty bad drug addiction.
Okay.
And I think he, in so many ways, he wanted to show me bands like Minor Threat, Youth of Today, kind of stuff of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
In hopes that I wouldn't be like him, right? Given that we came from like the same household and struggled with a lot of the same things kind of growing up. So
right.
I have like a very intimate kind of connection to kind of straight edge, you know?
Right.
And it was at like a pretty young age that like I kind of claimed it, quote unquote, as yeah. they call it, as like a lifestyle. And I was like probably like 13, 14.
Wow.
And I will say, like, you know, it kind of helped me get through a lot, you know, mm-hmm. just because of a lot of like probably like the predispositions I had grown up as a kid and stuff like that.
Sure.
You know, it's something I've kind of like kept up with just like over the years, as you know, it's been something that's been pretty helpful to me, something that I like respect. But I think most importantly, you know, I think as a younger kid and even as like a young adult, you know, it provided me with a lot of structure that I think I needed.
Right.
To not kind of get like lost in the wash, so to speak.
I hear you, man. In yeah. growing up, and you grew up in like the Chicago area?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. Grew up, you know, in a suburb right outside, but I've been kind of in the Chicagoland area my whole life.
Nice. Were there yeah, any yeah. local bands or touring bands that came through and drummers of those bands even that you saw at a young age that maybe gravitated you towards music and or the drums specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my first shows was Fugazi, actually.
Yeah.
You know, it was Fugazi, Shellac, and Yex at the Congress Theater. I was 13. I think I was in eighth grade at that time.
Nice.
I was able to watch like Brendan Canty play drums for the first time, like in a live setting. And up until that point, like I was like a really big Fugazi fan, thanks to my brother.
Yeah.
And seeing his style, right?
Yeah.
And just kind of seeing it in a live setting like that, I was just like so drawn to that, and it became like a really big influence on me as a drummer at that time, because there was just so much cool finesse to it. It was yeah. so creative, you know, and it just like totally helped me like reconceptualize like what punk drumming, you know, if you want to call Fugazi a punk band, but like what punk drumming could really like look like.
Oh, and, yeah.
And be like
100%. And I mean, I interviewed Brendan, and it was awesome talking to him. I told him that, you know, if you look out the sort of timeline of major drum influences, Ringo was a big one, you know, and then you have like Neil Peart for maybe more technical people. You have all the jazz greats, you have funk greats and this, that, and the other. But mm-hmm. I told him he was kind of my Ringo as well. And fully to sort of echo what you said, not only did mm-hmm. he sort of change my mind about what punk drumming could be, but also Fugazi for sure. And I give zero fucks about the debate over whether they were punk or not. I don't like, it's beyond chords. They certainly had the attitude. They had, you know, lyrically, they had all of that, everything that punk needed without having to be confined to a particular chord structure.
Absolutely.
Or a certain beat. They could do all that. So in many ways, I would argue that they evolved punk quite possibly beyond many other bands that I could even think of.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, needless to say, I'm a major fan, and I'm totally with you on the Brendan Canty thing. He's so good.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and I would say, you know, if anything, all those things that you listed about Fugazi, like yeah. make them more punk in and of themselves.
Agreed.
You know?
Yeah, they had the balls to do what they did, and there's something to be said for that. That in and 100%. Of itself was punk as fuck.
Absolutely.
To deviate from that sort of formula, you know.
Absolutely, man. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. In Harm's Way, throughout the records, you've got like passages of double bass patterns and stuff, certain sections that have some sustained double bass. You know, have you gone through phases of where you've had to really focus on double bass playing, or were you able to develop sort of it with the band and when it was needed within the song?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, I Harm's Way was like really the band that forced me to learn how to play double bass.
Yeah.
I would say yeah. in a lot of ways. So I feel like as our sound has evolved, obviously like my drumming has evolved with that, you know,
sure.
and like obviously my double bass technicality, so to speak, if mm-hmm. you want to call it that. So, Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can hear with like every record, just like some of the kind of rhythmic differences, some of the, you know, sustained kind of kick patterns, so to speak, mm-hmm. kind of come with that, you know?
Right.
So yeah, absolutely. Like Harm's Way definitely like pushed me with that and kind of has made it way more part of my skill set, so to speak.
Right. Necessity, as it turns out, is the mother of invention, huh?
100%. Yeah.
It's a funny thing because like that is another sort of derivation of sort of the punk roots that are within the hardcore thing. You wouldn't necessarily hear double bass so much within that, but everything has become sort of this amalgamation of so many influences, especially with the access to all the information in the world. Sometimes it's hard to even tell the origins of anything, and it's almost become this sort of, you know, nebulous, almost like influentially, like some of the music that you hear. But so, for instance, if you were listening to certain like early hardcore, I feel like you wouldn't, and especially punk for sure, like you would almost never hear double bass in that. But you hear some of that, obviously. I don't know. When did that even start? Could you pinpoint like when that might have even started necessarily? Like double bass influence within hardcore?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, you know, but, you know, I remember like, you know, I remember hearing like bands like kind of like Judge or like the Cro-Mags, so to speak, you
right.
know, and these like these hardcore bands that had these metallic leanings just starting to incorporate mm-hmm. aspects of like, you know, what would be considered like metal drumming, so to
right.
speak, and just starting to like kind of change the game in that sense, you know. And I think obviously as like stuff kept evolving, you know, like you kind of get to this, you know, metalcore era, so to
right.
speak, and it's everywhere.
Totally.
You know, as a kid and as like a punk drummer, and like double bass just like wasn't in even in like my sight, you know.
There was a straight up stigma because I was playing like more rock and roll with like sort of punk leaning stuff, and there was if I showed up with a double bass, people would have been like, get that shit out of here. Like there was a
yeah.
stigma about bringing a double bass pedal on a gig.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, if you know, to be able to do fast doubles, right, to be able to like mimic something that would, you know, seemingly only be could only be done with like a double kick pedal. Like, you know, if you could do that, you were like badass, you know?
Right.
and you know, you kind of look at metal drummers and who are playing the quote unquote like cheat beat, so to speak, or something like that. And you'd be like, oh, fuck that. I can do that with 1 foot, you know? But you know, you kind of get older, you start to see like the necessity of things needing to be and sound cleaner, you know, and
right.
you start to kind of grow and evolve and start to appreciate just like the evolution of drumming, you know,
for
and
sure.
the evolution of your own game, you know, and shit, like it gets boring just playing the same shit all the time, you know?
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. At once there was a subgenre metalcore, they were identifying and recognizing that there were inherent metal influences within the hardcore sort of also subgenre, and that was the segue. So that
right.
that makes sense. I know, like I've seen Norma Jean multiple times. Did you ever get to see them live?
Yeah, so funny enough, going back to my younger years, you know, maybe my second or third show was actually seeing Norma Jean when they were under the name Ludacris.
Oh wow, you saw them when that was, I guess that, I mean, I suppose, was that like new metal? That was like pre-metal? I don't know. Who knows? Fuck.
Yeah. You know, crazy. Like I won these tickets to go to this like Christian hardcore show that Stretch Armstrong and like Ludacris were like, you know, both playing. Right. But that
wow.
was like my first, that was like kind of like my first, you know, my first exposure to them. I think they would later become Norma Jean, you know, down the line, so to speak. But,
right. That's wild.
Yeah, yeah. So I did get to see them, and I was just like, whoa, this is insane. it was like in some ways, kind of like some of my early exposure to like kind of metalcore too.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I wanted to ask you about the snare drums. I've liked the snare drum sound that you've gotten on the records and in the live clips, and I've seen y'all live before. Do you have a go-to snare that you use both in the studio and live? Is there some crossover there? What are you playing?
Yeah, so I play a Blackwood custom drums, like kind of like Black Beauty Rip, with some diecast hoops on there.
Oh, you okay? You got the diecast on it. Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. And over the years, like I've kind of always played like kind of different Black Beauty rips with
same here,
different depths and like different same kind here. Of hoops and stuff like same that. Here. But like kind of brass snares have always been like
black nickel over brass. Yeah,
absolutely. It has like always been my thing. You know, I was like a big fan of like the Ed Rose recordings. You know, Catskill Lottery. You know, Appleseed Cast, like bands like that. And I was just like, how does he get the snare sound? Sounds amazing. And lo and behold, it's just like, oh, it's just like an old Black Beauty. And I might be totally wrong on all his recordings on that, but like, that's what I heard. So I was just like, that's what I'm going to buy. And obviously the Black Beauty snare is obviously just like a household name in right. all the drummers. Right.
Right. Right.
So that's like my typical like go-to.
It sounds like that's what you play. I have, again, I've got some as well that are sort of alternate versions of that, but still yeah. black nickel over brass. Maybe the lugs are a little bit different, but and the rims sure. can vary, whether it's like, you know, triple flange to, I don't know that I necessarily have diecast. That's interesting that you do, but that snare sound is close to, I mean, that's essentially what a Black Beauty sounds like tuned in that range.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And for Posthuman, actually, I used a Tama Bell brass snare.
Oh, wow. Where'd you get? Do you own one?
I don't own one. It is, it's actually, yeah, it's a snare that lives at Graphic Nature with Putney.
Damn.
Which, like, I fell in love.
Yeah,
with
of course
that
you
snare.
Did.
I, you know, it just like blew my mind. You know, I like, yeah. I like went into recording and I was like, yeah, I really want to use, I like Black Beauty all day, you know?
Yeah.
And he's just like, well, how about this Tama Bell brass? And I was just like, okay. And like, we did different tunings throughout the whole record, but it was like the main snare
Damn.
On that record. And like, I totally fell in love with that. And then doing Common Suffering, use another bell. I used the bell brass, but it was actually a Blackwood bell brass. I think it was like a B20 shell, you know, something like that.
Wow.
And amazing, you know, so big, big fan of like bell brass. I just don't want to tour with the snare that heavy ever.
I hear you, man.
Yeah.
So I've heard people throw around the sort of industrial phrase with your band. And I guess to my ear, I hear it more maybe in the form of segues or interludes of pre-recorded stuff with kind of crazy sounding drums, et cetera. But what is the industrial influence, if that is the case, that you hear sort of within your own music?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're all big fans of obviously industrial music, and obviously being from Chicago and the whole kind of Wax Trax history, you know, it just has kind of like come with the territory, so to speak, you know, like I don't think we call ourselves an industrial band per se, you know, but it's definitely influences our sound in a capacity for sure, whether it's like some of the interlude stuff that like maybe you were kind of hitting on. But I mean, there's a lot of our songs, or a good chunk of our songs, actually like incorporate a lot of those textures, so to speak, like maybe like different samples, right? Or
right.
some just like sample drums, you know, in addition to obviously like acoustic drums.
Right.
It's definitely there. And, you know, it's just something that we will consciously kind of like pull in if we feel like it's kind of fitting the vibe and like fitting the overall sound of the song.
When it comes time to execute that live within those songs are clicked out and or the pre-recorded stuff is queued up. So you're rolling with it then. So to speak, live.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, obviously up until most recently, because now we're actually starting to enter the world of kind of running tracks with Click and stuff like that.
Yeah.
A lot of those textures were kind of triggered more organically during the set, like with sample pads or pedals.
Gotcha.
And, you know, it was kind of crazy. You know, just kind of run ears and just kind of play along to the sample I was like hearing, you know, and just like praying for the best, so to speak. And in a lot of ways, you know, it's worked 90% of the times. Yeah, we've had some like probably train wreck moments, you know, when something goes wrong, you know.
Of course.
But that was our way of still trying to keep it like, you know, still pretty punk and still feeling live, so to speak, you know.
Yeah.
But I think like with like kind of Common Suffering and really trying to respect like all the textures that show up on that record and all the additional elements and kind of soundscapes, like we're really trying to kind of bring that to the live show and start, as I mentioned earlier, starting to play around with more like kind of tracks that are going to be running and kind of triggered on their own and having like a live show to kind of accompany ourselves with our own live show. that makes sense.
Nice, man. I was looking back at some of the flyers and social media of the Harm's Way social media, and I saw that y'all had played some shows with Trap Them. Once again, another Kurt Ballou produced series of records. I believe Brad Fickhuyzen was in the band at that point. I didn't see him with Chris Maggio, but I did see them quite a few times, maybe four or five times with Brad, and every time they were preposterously intense. Killer sound, just like the front man, so crazy, so intense. I was curious as to your perspective on playing shows with them.
Yeah, you know, we toured with them with Converge back in Europe, and awesome band, amazing band. You know, I was a big fan of, you know, like kind of the earlier Trap Them stuff. So to be able to tour with them was really, really fucking cool. And I think the best way to describe it was intense. Sharing a bus with some of those guys after the show was like really interesting, because it's just kind of like, you know, Nate from Converge and Ben and like James and I are just trying to like play cards, and you look and there's just, oh, someone's bleeding next to me and we're just going to the next city, you know.
Yeah,
but like really, really cool experience, and like so fucking good live and so intense.
Yeah,
like you said.
Yeah, dude, for a band in harm's way that consistently plays pretty crazy shows, are there any in particular where you've thought to yourselves, any other members of the band or collectively for that matter, that the whole place was about to get the roof blown off, and or just the, you know, the train was running off the tracks, for fuck's sake?
There's a specific show that like kind of comes to mind, which was like in our much earlier years. It was in Camarillo, California, and it was like the second show we were doing that day, and we ended up hopping on this like other show, and it actually involved some people who would later become friends of ours, but there was a moment where there was like a big fight, and the next minute there's a chair that's getting thrown across the room into this scuffle that is like going on, and there's YouTube clips of it too if you'd like to see it. But it was like one of those moments where we're just kind of like, holy shit, this can go south really quick.
Yeah, a riot is about to ensue.
Yeah. And it was like around that time that we kind of developed this mentality of like, oh, we're not stopping if people get in fights. Fuck that. We're going to keep playing, you know, yeah. Like we're here to rip, you know.
Yeah.
But it was one of those moments where just like, oh, hey, maybe we should stop. There's a chair in the air right now.
Right.
So, yeah. But I would say like since then, you know, like our shows have obviously like kind of, I wouldn't say chilled out, but they become far more contained.
Right. Yeah. It's a funny thing, because I mean, you mentioned Fugazi. I would go see him, and you know, Ian MacKay would have those moments where he would stop the show and escort somebody out, refund them their door money, and kick them out himself if he needed to, you know. And at there's a certain segment of like the hardcore sort of scene with like the sort of crowd killing and like super violent kind of like, you know, flailing and whatnot. And I'm always like, it's funny that, and I'm not saying that is every show, but sometimes there is that element where they come out and they're clearly looking to just start kind of hitting people and just starting shit, you know?
Yeah.
And like I've been to a couple of Every Time I Die shows, and there's something, I don't know if it's people from Buffalo, I don't know, hockey fan, I don't, football fan, I don't understand what happens, but I was just like, who the fuck are these guys? Why is this even happening? It's a strange thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you're saying, like, if you're playing a show, you can't be fully aware of what's going on until it probably gets so out of hand that you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
You know, from an audience member standpoint, I'm always like, what? Why is that? It's a bizarre thing to me. I don't get it. But, you know, I'm 47. I have kids and I, you know, I go to shows, but I'm certainly not moshing anymore. I can't get fucking injured.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm 36, you know, and we've been doing this band like a really long time. And like the last thing we want is, you know, people simply coming to our shows to kind of hurt each other. Stuff happens, right? Like you're really into the music. For some people, the way that they express themselves at a show is to fucking mosh hard, right? You know, and like kind of like do their thing, you know? And sometimes like stuff happens and like we get that, you know, it's like obviously hardcore punk, metal, industrial, whatever, you know, like it's, it becomes a space like kind of self-expression for us, for the audience, you know, and we get that like stuff happens. But like when someone is intentionally like trying to like hurt someone or just there to hurt someone, you know, I don't know. To me, that's fucking whack. And it almost feels feels disrespectful to us too. Cause like, we're not writing this music simply for you to like go hurt people, you know, like this is, this is so much more to us than that, you know.
Totally.
This band's a vehicle for self-expression, like I said, for catharsis, for like you name it.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you just hope people are there to like obviously do their thing, but also like respect themselves and others, you know, while they're there. So
right on, man. Well, touring wise, what do y'all have coming up? I know y'all announced something. Y'all are doing a full US run.
Yeah. Yeah. So, October 18th, we leave for, a full US run supporting Common Suffering,
nice.
Our new LP. And, we'll be going out with, Fleshwater, Ingrown, and, Jive Bomb.
Okay.
So that'll be full US, you know, kind of starting in the Midwest, going east, heading west, and then cutting back across and then in Chicago.
Sounds good, man. I've got an alter. If y'all are ever looking for any comedic content, I sometimes I wake up in the night. I don't know. I think this was last night that I woke up thinking about this, but I was thinking about your vocalist, James. If at any point y'all want to do a sort of a comedic skit for him, I think it would be absolutely hilarious to see him baking cupcakes.
Baking cupcakes.
Yeah, wearing an apron and making like little pink cupcakes.
You know, the man likes to cook, and he definitely had a baking phase in college at one point where he was like baking cakes and making like protein cakes and stuff like that. So I wouldn't put it past them.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. But how long have y'all known each other?
Shit. I've known Bo, our guitar player. Like we go way back. Like we were like middle school friends.
Oh wow.
You know, one of our first bands ever, actually our first band ever was together. It was just kind of doing like punk covers and shit. And then we would later do, like our first actual band together called Double Cross, which was like high school, you know, 15, 16.
Of course.
We would meet James around that same time, like 16, 17, just from starting to go to like Chicago hardcore shows and stuff.
Wow.
We met James through, our friend, John Caution, who was kind of like our first friend in the proper Chicago hardcore scene. And we just all kind of started hanging out from there. And later we would just start doing bands, and, you know, we've all kind of been best friends since.
Damn, dude, small world. How about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, it's crazy to think like, you know, I've known James about almost 20 years now, you know?
Wow. Wild. Yeah. Wild.
And 17 of those years, 18 of those years, they've been doing Harm's Way. So kind of wild. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, congrats on the new record. Again, it sounds great. Looking forward to seeing y'all, and good luck on the tour, man. I think it's going to be a good one.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you having me tonight, and hopefully I'll see you in Atlanta.
Absolutely. All right, everybody, thanks for tuning in. Hope y'all enjoyed the episode. Thanks to Chris for hanging, and congrats to Harm's Way on the new record and upcoming tour. Hope y'all can catch him out on the road ripping it up. We'll catch y'all on the next one. Crash, bang, boom.